250,000 miles away, the moon. This is the moon that men have worshipped as a goddess, that countless lovers have sighed over and sworn by. It will take immense courage to journey to this place, for on this pitted and pocked ball of pumice and stone, there is no atmosphere, no air to breathe, no sound to hear.
Got a ticket to the moon.
And we're starting our coverage later than expected today as flight controllers continue to assess Nova C's trajectory, guidance, navigation, and control. Nova C maintained a low lunar orbit, but is in a slightly more elliptical shape. Last night, flight controllers performed a lunar correction maneuver burn to adjust the lander's orbit. This burn kept Nova C on a trajectory to land in Malapert A, but moved our landing time estimates earlier by about an hour. Then today, flight controllers chose to exercise an additional orbit before starting the IM-1 mission landing sequence. This decision brought us to now, projecting a landing time of 1724 Central Time.
On the eighth day of a 250,000-mile voyage, a voyage along the great cosmic bridge from the launch pad at the Kennedy Space Center to the target of the south pole of the moon, a commercial lander named Odysseus, powered by a company called Intuitive Machines, launched upon a SpaceX rocket carrying a bounty of NASA scientific instruments and bearing the dream of a new adventure.
Since launch today, now traveling over 12,800 miles per hour, 563 miles downrange. Again, still quiet here in Mission Control, Houston.
Welcome to Voice Print Identification.
2001.
A space pause?
I'm Wes.
I'm Brad.
Thank you. You are cleared through Voice Print Identification.
With animal sauce, but yes. Not animal style, because that includes onions. I hate onions.
Me too.
You ever had In-N-Out with animal sauce?
Never.
Ooh.
When I was in Anaheim, I think we were supposed to, but it didn't shake out, unfortunately. Stupid.
No, but I can't remember those shakes. I'm sure they were good.
Yeah.
Closest thing we have is Sonic, but the Sonic that we have is on the top of a hill, very, very steep hill.
Yeah.
It's very dangerous for them to wear roller skates.
Oh my gosh. I remember within the first few years of them opening, some of them did wear roller skates, and I couldn't believe it because that hill is a death wish. I'm not kidding. It's like a 45 degree angle.
into traffic, by the way, into oncoming highway traffic.
Four lanes. But I think they got paid 50 cents more an hour back when I knew somebody that worked there. So
they got paid 50 cents more for wearing the skates?
For wearing the skates. So it was incentivized. Can you believe that?
That's amazing.
They're definitely not footing your insurance bill. I know that.
Hey! You're on a pun roll here.
Shutting down. If I do three, I open up a black hole and the Leonov just gets completely destroyed. We don't want that.
No, but we could use
some better news from our freight service. You know, we've been on the Leonov for a few weeks now. It's been pretty boring, but you know, we're keeping our wits about us.
Yeah.
I had gotten a data stream of information from what was supposed to be an incoming delivery to restock our vending machines. And
you're going to tell me bad news on the air?
I've got the very sad news that our shipment of Andy Capp's hot fries aboard the Odysseus did not reach its target landing. So unfortunately, it did make contact with the lunar surface, but it is very far away from Clavius Base. Oh, and no. Latest reports say that it's leaning on its side. I can only imagine that the payload has been completely destroyed or ejected into the lunar surface.
Or stolen.
So maybe we can dust off a couple bags at some point.
Yeah, good thing we have a reserve.
Now, I'm wondering how this would work, because I believe the protocol for those is to be filled with nitrogen, which is an inert. Funyuns? The Funyuns and the hot fries.
Oh.
In fact, I think most packaged chips are sealed with nitrogen to prevent staleness and any kind of contaminants or anything like that. So bags full of nitrogen on the lunar surface, I don't know if they're going to go up or
yeah.
If that's not going to be a problem. You know, if you're savvy in this field, please write in.
So do you think that there could be a cloud of floating Andy Capp's hot fries bags that the next lander is going to have to
they could be through? Yeah, it's possible. If they're lucky, it'll be in a tidally locked orbit.
That's how you'll know where the South Pole is.
Just a vast look for the hot fries. Vast field of Andy Capp's.
You all right, kiddo? I'm fine, Andy.
That's just what they'll do. And one of these days, these boots are gonna walk all over you.
I thought after the night before last you wasn't gonna drink anymore.
Flo, the state I'm in, I couldn't drink anymore. Good night.
Let me ask you this, as far as the nitrogen goes. So our air is like, what, 80% oxygen and then 20% nitrogen? Is that right?
Correct. No, I'm way out of my depth here, but I've got a diving anecdote. The black hole.
This is it. That's it. I'm sorry, Jupiter just turned into a star, everybody.
It's shrinking! It's shrinking!
But I believe they increased their nitrogen intake. They changed their mix as they go into deeper areas of either ocean diving or cave diving. I think the saturation of it has to change because of the way it enters the bloodstream.
Mm.
So depending on what the pressure is, I mean, if you're sucking these bags of Andy Capp's hot fries, we can't use this. It's just so dumb. Okay. But yes.
Yeah.
So, snip, snip. Unfortunately, that payload has been lost to the lunar surface.
I came over from Mission Control today, and the mission director for the white team in Mission Control, Jack Fisher, gave a little speech to celebrate Odie, our lander, on the surface, and what a magnificent job that robust, plucky lander did all the way to the moon and then on the surface to deliver back to NASA and our commercial companies so much data and information and science. It's just an incredible testament to how robust and like someone said, beastly that little spacecraft is.
The Odysseus mission overall has been a success. This is the first time in a very long time that we've had anything from our side of the globe touching the lunar surface.
Since the last thing that we were talking about in NASA history, which was Skylab, right? So it's been since after Skylab was the last Apollo missions,
was
right?
Was that when they placed the reflective plate down on the lunar surface? I can't remember.
But we're talking about late 70s?
Yeah.
Wow.
It's been forever. And we've had some international attempts and some successes. There was the Indian mission that...
Which was...
So close.
Oh.
And it was really a triumph because India is so new to the space. That has got to be so difficult trying to have a trajectory for such a rocky surface and unforgiving regolith-ridden expanse. And then on top of that, having minimal gravity, just almost nothing. If you hit the surface too hard, you're going to bounce. If you thrust too hard, you're going to lose your trajectory and go back into orbit. I mean, there's so many variables in that.
And similarly with the Odysseus, it's getting to be the butt of a lot of jokes and late night show
gags.
But honestly, you know, it really is a triumph and a resounding success. It landed on its side, but all the instruments are fine. Everything can still function. All the three doors can open. The only door that can't open wasn't a door. It was the side where Jeff Koons' art installation was. I thought it was like a painting or something. Look at it. No, it's just like a giant display cabinet. A clear acrylic display cabinet with little silver balls in it. They're the phases of the moon.
Yeah.
And there's like 15 of them, I guess. It's actually one of the most moving and emotional Jeff Koons pieces that I've seen. It's a real shame for the art, but the real jokes, of course it tipped over on that side. It's not a painting on the side of the wall. It's a giant acrylic case full of silverware. Screwed onto the side of it. You think it might be a little heavy on that? Might tip over on that side?
It's almost poetic.
No, of course, that was the foot that caught the rock, you know, when it was on its way down. But what happened was it was supposed to be a new laser guidance system that they were going to use to land it, right? But it didn't work. They come to find out they left the lens cap on.
Yeah. There was supposed to be a safety release right before launch, and that just didn't get on the checklist or was just...
As my brother was saying, it's like stuff can be lethal to your eyes. So, of course, when they're installing that thing, you're going to run the check from the power and everything, make sure the lasers are working. You don't want the lasers to be squirting into your eye. But eventually,
and this was going to be a great implementation of LIDAR, which... That Ta-da! Seems to be hitting the headlines. I mean, it is the buzzword.
Oh, listen, I'm...
LIDAR is just a... It's been around for a while. Now that it's been completely pocketized, commercialized, mm-hmm. and deployed in so many different ways that have been beneficial for even archaeologists. I mean, finding things in the Amazon that we've been looking for years and years and be able to just bombard the canopies of these thick forests with this incredible laser and then come back and find that there are in fact ancient ruins and previous settlements from probably previous to the Mayan and Incan cultures hidden in there.
Incredible.
So, yeah, it's absolutely incredible.
So LIDAR is on your phone, everybody. Chances are if you have a phone within the last 3 years or maybe even 4 or 5 years with Apple, I'm not sure with iPhones, but basically it looks like a little pearl.
People ask, you know, why was this so hard and why does it take so much effort if we've returned to the moon after 50 years, why, and we did it 50 years ago, why is it so hard? What we had was a different kind of challenge. We were constrained in cost with a fixed price performance contract from the government. We had a schedule where we were to get this mission completed within the time it takes to get an undergraduate degree. We had a technical challenge to land softly on the South Pole region of the moon. This over-constrained environment, forced innovation, and this was our first flight of this vehicle, which had never been flown before in space, let alone been designed and developed. And this was a task that was given formally to nation states and sovereign governments, and we did it as a commercial company. We did this by building a robust lunar program that could launch and land more than one time. That is in place. The Intuitive Machines operations team has been practiced now like no other and can handle the challenges that are thrown for flying in space.
It's a victory for NASA, and it's a victory for the company.
They're called Intuitive Machines.
So we know the engine belt contacted the surface. The landing gear took the bulk of the load, and we broke one or two possibly landing gear. And so we sat there upright with the engine firing for a period of time. And then as it wound down, the vehicle just gently tipped over. And in our simulation with 1/6 gravity, we showed that it took about 2 seconds. And we landed on a 12-degree slope. And then that 12-degree slope, compounded with the helium tank underneath or a radio shelf, would put us at an angle that's approximately 30 degrees off the surface. And we have that photo now to confirm that's the orientation. We also know the roller orientation when we were going to set the high gain antenna towards Earth and the solar arrays for the sun. We know that roll worked, but we know when we landed, the top deck solar array was shadowed and we weren't generating power with the top deck solar array, so we got that orientation right. So those were all the parameters that had to unfold over time to get us a good understanding of where we came. And then just today, we have this picture of us leaning gently on the surface.
The LRO image, if you look at it, there's a large crater not far from where we landed. If you look in the middle of the picture, you see there's kind of a dark band. That is that crater. And so the beginning of that dark band is the shadow into that, what Mark Robinson from ASU tells me is probably a 2-billion-year-old crater. And the first edge of that darkness is about 500 meters from where we are. And then the ridge beyond that is another 500 meters, so about a kilometer away. And then you can see kind of a light band just underneath the helium tank, which is the lunar surface on the far side of that crater. So that'll give you an idea when you look at the picture of how we're oriented.
The fact that NASA's built-in guidance system was able to work because of the rigors of NASA's standards, they had to have that on board, and you could be assured that a reboot mid-flight would not screw everything up before landing.
Yeah.
And it's because of that rigor and NASA's standards and protocol that they were able to use this backup method.
If they would have found this out at the moment of entry, it would have probably just smashed into the surface without them even really realizing it. Yeah, this is a long time coming, and I used to love tracking the progress of XPRIZE companies that would try to send craft to the moon. Do you remember that? This was a NASA-sanctioned event where private companies could build and deploy spacecraft to the lunar surface, and if they were able to do so, they won like I think it was a several million dollar prize or something like that. But also, I mean, you would win government contracts hand over fist.
Oh,
and
yeah.
What comes with that would be more than just what the prize was. And mm-hmm. I think that was kind of the intention of it, but no one was able to do it. I think XPRIZE was also one of the foundational contests that featured Virgin Galactic's Spaceship One, where they were able to make a privatized craft that could go into low Earth orbit and do so potentially as like a commercial venture. And they were able to win that. And I think that's why it's still being pursued as something that people can just get a ticket for, which is so cool.
We communicated in a way that not everybody was necessarily satisfied with. We learned in our communications. But what we tried to do was diagnose a problem and develop an approach and then communicate what our approach was going to be and how we were going to solve it that was going to improve or maintain Odie's health along the way. And I think we did that, and we did that effectively, and I'm proud of the communications team for what they have done. You know, data flows out of mission control in a very sporadic way, whether communications are happening in rapid pace and near real time, or they're delayed over the weekend because we're struggling with getting our telemetry down into these big dishes around the world. But every time we reported out the status of where we were. We've assembled the best and brightest in the company that I can imagine, and trying to create a business that's a national asset for the United States, and hopefully feed the lessons learned into IM2 and IM3 and our subsequent missions.
Obviously for us, because we're here, it's no big deal. But if you're on Earth, I mean, to think about everything that we dreamed of as kids and everything that that kid that we saw spend 2 hours with Chuck Schlim going through yeah. the future and the past of the space program. It's, you can taste it now, and that's insane.
It's such a unique opportunity for our species to be able to view everything that keeps us alive from such a perspective. And I've heard several astronauts go on and on about how inspiring and incredible from that viewpoint our planet really seems, and it's hard to get that perspective from a photograph or
yeah.
something digitized. And I think experiencing the real thing is becoming more of a reality than we ever thought possible.
You know, if all of the billionaires and all the people who are making decisions on high corporate and governmental levels that are affecting all of the world right now are wanting to go up there, send them. And I'm not making a joke about don't let them come back or something. I'm saying, because everybody that goes and then comes back, whether they're astronauts or civilians, all say the same thing. How incredibly humbling it is, and how much they fall in love with the Earth, and how precarious and beautiful everything is that we have.
Yeah, a lot of them refer to it as seeming delicate.
Yeah.
And you really, from that scale, I mean,
if that's what it takes to humble people in positions of power to get the perspective.
If we could get several cupola-like objects, and let's not put warheads.
Let's put one of Arthur's elevators up there.
Yeah.
You know, you can just take the elevator up into the stratosphere.
Mm-hmm.
And even that,
you could just take a bus to Clavius Base.
Well, exactly. Well, we'll have
because once you're in Leo, it gets so much less expensive to get from there to any of our neighboring planetoids, depending on their position in their orbital rotation.
The reason that all of this is pitched towards the South Pole and the dark side of the moon is because they want to be building a moon base to be facing outward to where we're going to be projecting and launching people to Mars and so forth.
Yeah, a Stargate.
Yeah.
The reason some of this data took a while for us to get to is we had to really work with our in-network lunar telemetry partners, and then also with DSN to figure out what this strange environment was. Absolutely, our signals were bouncing off the moon. So we were receiving both the direct path signals from our radio and the opposite polarization as well. And so we had to sort through exactly how to do that. But once we got it down, we got into a rhythm where we could monitor health and send some basic commands for about 16 hours a day. And then we'd come over Australia, and we were able to really pull down data for about 8 hours at a time. And that was intense. That's where we had everybody in there. We had no dead air, just like in the radio business. There was no dead air, right? We wanted data coming down all the time. Well, I want to fix this payload. I want to work with scouts. Great. Be downloading data while you're working with scouts. And so that was kind of the operation we had. I know that wasn't your question, but I just wanted to talk about it. So, sorry.
And I think one of the other interests, too, was the fact that the area they were going to survey have instances of craters that never see sunlight and some that have like a rotational period where they do indulge, and the possibility of having water ice detectable in those craters. I think that was one of the missions that was on a payload there.
What's this I hear about a pogo stick?
What?
From one school to another, where preparation means oiling your pogo stick. All over the country, everyone's jumpy. Here at Weybridge, Surrey, they even have a pogo stick sports day. And what a day it is. They're under starters' orders and approaching the line. Smith Miner's mount looks a little skittish, but he's quietened it. There's a hush as everyone waits for the off. Any just-can't-wait self-respecting businessman should keep a pogo stick in the boot of his car. When a traffic jam looms ahead, he can still get to the office on time.
In the summer, I believe, is when they're going to be firing off the lunar pogo stick by Intuitive Machines.
Oh.
So phase two, after Odysseus, is going to be a giant pogo stick.
Okay.
It's going to it'll have, the chute and everything, and it'll drop down, and it'll have a little spider legs or a hat stand, legs. And you can see, you can just envision the beauty of this engineering. This long pole, which then will have a little drill inside of it that can burrow down from the bottom of the drill while it's standing on its legs and drill into the ground in the center to take a sample of the ice, bring it back, and then doink, bounce across the surface back to the base, and it'll be able to be controlled from Mission Control Base and Intuitive Headquarters in Houston.
That's incredible.
I mean, not only is that brilliant in terms of gravitationally, just having this thing doing, doing on the low gravity.
Visually, that's got to be killer.
What was that game? One of the first computer games, Lunar Lander game, where you're trying not to tip over on the...
Yeah.
Right?
I think it's just called Lander.
Yeah.
Maybe?
So, you know, you got time to change things because you can steer away from that thing. And if you don't steer away from it, you're not smashing up against it. It's a tiny little doink. It's just one...
So I imagine it probably has like a gyroscope in it to keep it balanced.
I think so. And I think it would probably, the legs would be able to kick it back to right itself up to a certain degree, cool. I guess.
I'd like to see a whole fleet of those going.
And how horrifying, though, if you're in crew of Artemis 2 and then suddenly the first thing you're met with is this giant pogo stick with a needle coming out of the
sprinkler system issue.
Yeah, and giant legs. But that'll be it, because to water the plants that they're going to grow in the greenhouse, they want to use that water.
And I think they were thinking about using magma caves. I think there are chambers of magma close to the lunar surface that could be hollowed out and used as like a foundation for a base. Like the shielding from radiation and everything would be there already. We would just need to make atmosphere and make a way to get all of those. I can't remember what all they could harvest from the surface. I think it was helium, obviously, from the water ice. They could make not only water, but oxygen.
Yeah.
They could do it Mark Watney style through electrolysis.
Yeah, yeah.
In the face of overwhelming odds, I'm left with only one option. I'm gonna have to science the shit out of this.
Well, the latest cloud seeding technology is mind-blowing. You know what they're doing in Iowa right now? These cloud seeding situations where bowls where they're injecting nitrous oxide, is it? No, it's silver oxide.
And I think that triggers rainfall, right?
Yeah, and they're mixing it with propane now, which is the new thing.
Oh,
and the propane, the propane helps distribute it. It also expands the range where the silver oxide will have an effect, because it doesn't have to be below freezing for it to work, because the propane distribution atmospherically cools it artificially to make it cold enough to create the condensation, and it produces more. They actually get more moisture out of the clouds with this recipe than actually comes out naturally.
And the silver oxide can be created in laboratory conditions, right?
Apparently it's pretty cheap. And propane is, you know...
Propane. Propane is propane.
Inside of the day.
Need we say more? Propane.
That's right, exactly.
I live in the real world where men sell propane and propane accessories.
In December, I think, is when the robots are coming.
Oh.
It's called Cadre.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's computer-assisted robot explorers.
Are these going to be more bouncy boys? Like,
these are not bouncy boys. These are Roomba boys. These are little Roombas.
Oh, okay.
Actually, these are the Roombas that we ordered, but they've decided to sequester those for another purpose, and they've reprogrammed them. So we're going to have to keep sweeping, apparently, and using this 25-year-old Kenmore vacuum. And
I told them to install a dust curtain. I don't know why this hasn't happened yet.
George, is that you?
Sure, honey, and I found Rosie, and I brought her back home this day. She wants to know how much we charge her to let her work for us.
Don't be silly, Rosie. You are worth your weight in leftovers.
Thank you. And I love you people, too.
Hey, Rosie, is this how to sink a basket?
Very good, Roy boy. Except you'll have to learn to let go of it.
Not tonight, Elroy. It's time to blast off for dreamland.
I'm trying to get this right, because I remember reading that it's five. Yeah, a payload of five robots, autonomous little robots that will explore on their own, map the geography, and do a geosurvey, automatically analyzing and sending back data, and can be controlled remotely as a group as well to be steered into different areas.
Who's launching this program?
Phase three of
Intuitive. Oh, so this is part of... Okay.
Yeah.
Fantastic.
This is this year. all of this is happening this year.
Man, Europa Clipper.
And Europa Clipper is in October. And I mean, if Arthur C. Clarke could see what he did, because he was up there just a few weeks ago.
Yeah.
They fired him up there.
And, they certainly did.
And it's okay, that was not our fault. We want to say this now. We haven't had a chance to say this since Christmas when that happened. So
we were already on the Leonov.
Yeah, this, and it didn't actually leave Earth's atmosphere. I think it went cocky a little before it left and then turned around and
gave him a pretty good ride, though.
But it was only like a small, like a couple of tablespoons of Arthur and Roddenberry.
Yeah, I had to look that up immediately and see if it was...
There's plenty left. There's like 85% left, I think.
Yeah.
Now, I think the recipe called for maybe 87% left if we just used a little bit less and added some pepper.
But it also depends on what altitude you're at.
That's true. You altitude affects cooking a lot. In the higher elevations, it's harder to get yeast to rise.
On behalf of my husband and I, today I'd like to do treacle tart. And treacle tart, which comes from the Hind's Head at Bray-on-Thames, and that's where we're going to today. Fantastic spot. If you've ever gone up the Thames, punting your way up the Thames, you come to this, a nice bird in a mink.
This is a good week, man. We have had such a juicy week in science. To think about everything that's coming to our beautiful moon this year. Artemis 2 crew, our buddies, were supposed to join us, but the mission's getting pushed back another year for extra safety reasons, and we're all for that.
Yes. But that mission went really well.
It did. I mean, everything has
without
just
a hitch.
Beautiful. They got so much. It wasn't just a test ride, right? Because they had instruments strapped to those crash test dummies.
Yeah.
Vince, get up. Safety belt test at 9. Hurry.
Not another windshield taste test. Count me out.
What? The old pro backing down from a motorhome?
Nothing like that. I'm just tired of trying to convince people to wear safety belts. No one's listening.
Safety belt saved Barbara Mandrell.
You're right. Someone listen. Let's hit the road.
You hungry, partner?
Let's do some donuts on the way in.
Good idea.
You could learn a lot from a dummy. Buckle your safety belt.
Oh, my goodness. We were just talking about these wonderful action figures from our childhood.
This is the question, the mystery that hasn't been solved once they opened up the capsule. Who pushed the button in their bellies to pop off their heads and limbs?
Jeez, because I think they had a pretty turbulent... Was it during their reentry or was it during like a retro... I can't remember. But yeah, I think a few of them sustained some, not life-threatening injuries, but yeah, some concerning amount of G-force.
Well, not life-threatening since they were...
Well,
artificial,
certainly,
but as, wouldn't have
as
been
life-threatening as the sack of flour that you were forced to carry around as a child.
That poor sack of flour.
It's an honor to have you guys here. I'm terribly excited for your mission, but certainly not as much as you guys are. You've been announced as the Artemis 2 mission. Artemis 1 went out unmanned. You guys are gonna go out the first crewed mission. Let's start with something obvious for the people out there who don't necessarily believe in the final frontier. Let's start with you as the commander, Reed. Why are we going back to the moon?
Because we want to see humans on Mars.
Yeah. Oh, so this is step one.
This.
Okay. Yes. How does that help?
So we've been living and working on the International Space Station for about the last 24 years. You know it well. You love it. You have the cupola above us.
Sure. There it is.
And so that was the first step in understanding humans off the planet. The next step to getting to Mars is to go learn how to work around the moon, get to deep space, get away from Earth, learn how to work on another celestial body. Once we have that nailed down, then we are going to Mars.
What about the resources that we need to get from the moon to Mars? Where's the fuel come from?
So there's a lot of different opportunities, but we are almost positive there is ice on the moon in some of these shadowed regions of the crater. So we're going to go
up.
South
Pole is supposed to have a big old lake of ice, right?
And
like
that
the
is
size
why...
of Puerto Rico or something.
Big, big. Can somebody fact check him? I don't know about that.
It is some fraction of Puerto Rico. So that's what I know.
That is why we want to go there on our next mission. We want to go, not the four of us, but our colleagues will go to the South Pole of the moon to look for this ice, to look for this water, and potentially we can use that to get to Mars.
This is infrastructure. This is crazy. Artemis is going to be building IKEA style, like opening up payloads. Intuitive is dropping like a new moon buggy.
I heard about the
new
moon buggies.
Like
yes.
Truck, basically a flatbed for hauling big stuff for construction because they're going to be doing outdoor construction on the moon.
Yeah.
Put tab A into slot B and inflate.
As soon as we're able to fabricate on the lunar surface, things are going to exponentially grow. That's the biggest thing holding us back right now is the fact that these payloads are having to be constrained to such a small size just because of how expensive it is to lift that much material off of the surface of the Earth and get it into that lunar orbit. It's mind-boggling how much fuel that it takes. And it's like the more fuel you need, the more fuel you need. That compounding factor just makes it just unfeasible for companies of like a commercial nature to be able to do that on the regular. So to get some major construction done, we need a way to be able to harvest materials from the lunar surface and turn it into usable materials. And I don't know if it was the last episode or the one before, but we were talking about experimenting with growing mushrooms and using them as building material for habitats and things like that for the Martian colonies that are being proposed. Why not?
As Arthur said so beautifully, we have the capacity, but also the requirement and the obligation to dream big. And like with Skylab, what we kept seeing over and over again was you never know until you try, until you find out some crazy new reverse umbrella way of making a solar shield. The ability to improvise only comes through massive amounts of trial and error and experimenting.
And that's also something so perfect for our human development. Like we are so suited for improvising and reassessing situations and being able to be flexible. That's something that computers, robots, AI, the whole gamut, they've not been able to replicate. How intuitive and how innovative the human species can be.
Once on the moon, pod-shaped vehicles of very light construction will be used for transportation. Roy Karnan has visualized for Stanley Kubrick many of the unusual and striking sets for 2001. He has given form to scientific concepts of life on the moon in greater detail than any living artist. This complex is the shuttle base with a communication network in the background. This is the lunar shuttle with its access ramps and an observatory with its communication center. This is a segment of the moon's surface transport.
And how apt is it for this lander to be named Odysseus?
As soon as I heard its christening, I was just absolutely over the moon.
It's ringing! It's ringing!
Not only for us and our topic, but what the broader implications of what it is, the human odyssey that we're on, and this is the first step this back into it.
Also the legacy of Homer.
It is.
Being extended into like a very explorative sense in a way that we haven't been able to experience in a long time because, you know, ever since we've been alive, the world's been mapped, quote unquote, you know, not every boundary and cave and whatever has been explored, but this is truly such an honor to be able to extend the legacy of a great writer.
Amen. Frankly, the best joke and of any that I saw this week was on Twitter, somebody saying, if you wanted a perfectly smooth voyage that would go off without a hitch to its destination, you probably picked the wrong name. Anyone who's read The Odyssey knows.
That's wonderful.
But that's the beauty of the journey. I mean, this is not going to be an easy journey. It's not necessarily going to be always a safe one, which is why we need to be as safe as possible, because if we're 100% careful to be 200% sure, there's still like a one in a million chance that it's, everything's going to be okay.
Yeah.
It's a, this is, there's, there, there's no room for error because there's no
buffer.
There's no buffer. Yeah. There's no breathing room for error. All it takes is one puncture hole in your suit.
That's it.
If you don't have the gaffer tape,
yeah.
What do you do?
Yeah, you're finished.
Statistics show that even through today, newly developed rockets have a failure rate of 50%. And generally, there is no rocket that performs perfectly on the first flight. And yet, SLS performed magnificently. This vehicle was described by space experts as symmetry in motion. There were 140 planned test objectives in the timeline. Artemis 1 achieved each and every one with such precision that the teams expanded the envelope with 21 additional test objectives. Because of the Artemis 1 mission, we retired risks that could have delayed or unraveled the ambitions of this generation, our generation, to return to the moon.
I don't think it's unlike our early explorers when they were first taking, not the Polynesians, because they apparently just could master waves in canoes and catamarans, mm-hmm. you know?
Yeah, right.
They
yeah.
were amazing. But early European
the
history,
Western expansion,
the Western voyages and stuff, to take those ships anywhere outside of coastal sight was a huge, huge risk. And a lot of them, you know, did have a situation that could be akin to a puncture in a suit. And if you have a hole in your boat and you're weeks, months away from shore, you're not going to make it.
Yeah.
And I love how we adapt not only the idea of ships and other naval jargon to outer space, but it is so much like taking a boat out into the unknown.
And it's a crew mentality.
Absolutely.
It's crazy to think about. We needed these post-World War II Korea
heroes.
Flyboys, yeah, to start this program, because that's what it came from. It came out of the technology that was built during World War II, you know, and pre-World War II, the rockets that were being developed by von Braun and others, then, you know, went from V2 to then post-war technology. That naturally was the offshoot, and the only way to deliver it, because that was the pipeline and the methodology that it was being evolved from, out of a military thing into a civilian thing. And it has grown beautifully more civilian over the years, with more and more civilian astronauts and more diversity, so that there are more and more women and more people of different backgrounds and races. And every single one of them still has to have the right stuff.
Yes.
Because it's still just as dangerous as it ever was.
Absolutely. And I think, you know, coming out of that top talent, especially from Air Force juggernauts that had so much time in the seat, especially with experimental craft, you know, they were such a good poster child for launching these really daring and experimental flights into space. And that just kind of dovetailed nicely. But as the space program became more nuanced, and especially with the development of international collaborations leading up to International Space Station, we really wanted to see more diversity and more people represented. But you do absolutely have to have a high level either scientific skill set. You still have pilots that have to be
medical skill set, whatever your specialty is for the experiments that you're going to be doing up there. And
everyone
also
has their everyone's got hat on hat at that point. You know, that they're not only doing scientific missions, but they're totally trained in how to prepare for an evacuation to a Soyuz module if need be. It's like the passenger on the plane that sits next to the exit. They get the extra training on how to let everybody else out in case of emergency. But you're two things at all times. You're their pilot, coordinator, manager to a team, but you're also a scientist. And And the extrapolation from that is that you're going to get cream of the crop people that are going to be assigned these tasks because it's so demanding and it's something that only unique individual can fulfill.
It's a history-making mission in many ways. First Canadian, first woman, first person of color on a lunar mission. I assume... I assume you all have your own, people in the earlier space missions, in the earlier programs that are heroes of yours. Let's start with you, Christina. What's it mean to you now that you are that for other young people coming up?
It's an amazing feeling, honestly. I think the real thing to celebrate about this mission is that we've made a decision as an agency, as a country, that we are going to go for all and by all. If we're not taking contributions from every single person with the talent ready to share it, then we're not truly answering humanity's call to explore. So the fact that we're going in this era is what makes me most excited about this mission. And the fact that I might be able to inspire like those people that paved the path for me, that's just amazing icing on the cake.
The most exciting thing about right now is knowing how exponentially, not only that this is growing, but the applications are growing and the excuses for getting up there are growing because there are so many types of experiments that need to be done. It was very important. I hope you all wrote to your congresspeople and continue to write to your congresspeople to keep NASA funding at its full budget, because I'm telling you, if they have no other incentive to do it, just tell them the impact on cancer research, because we cannot begin to do the cancer research necessary for not only the presidential initiative, but just in general what we want as a society and as a species to do to eradicate, because cancer grows at such a faster speed in zero G.
We don't have to go through generations of laboratory mice and years of studies to culture these very specific genetic disorders. Something in zero G where there, I guess, the lack of gravity and like the ability to truly have a control, I guess. You're not subject to seasons, pressures. You're truly in like an isolation chamber that can help make these experiments more accurate and take less time to develop.
And over time, the things that are now happening in the space station will be moving down to the surface and being part of labs, these semi-permanent labs on the moon. You know, people will be going to work doing that.
I can't wait for actual Clavius space to be christened on the lunar surface. It's going to happen.
Yeah.
You know,
I mean, of course, we'll be the first invited.
But we'll be there. And the hot fries will be waiting for us. I think that is one thing that is absolutely on the no-fly is bags of chips, actually.
Interesting. Is it because of the dust and the crumbs?
There's something about it.
Or is it because they're closed?
I think it's the bags.
Oh, the silver stuff?
There's an incineration problem with it. I believe, if I'm not mistaken.
You don't want the hot fries to actually burst into flames
Let me actually look this up, because I do believe this is a thing.
Imagine how nightmarish that would be, because we both hate hot fries anyway, but how terrible would it be to have them actually immolate in your hand while you're trying to eat them?
Yeah, no, I guess that's not, that doesn't seem to be.
Okay, standard pressurized bag would not explode, but would pop. Okay, well, I've never been on mashed stuff. Are you looking up a mashed potato article?
Oh my God, are you? You're not wrong. Wait a second. Wait a second. Oh, you just broke my freaking mind. Yeah, I was just double checking because they do seal chips with nitrogen, and the air we breathe is 78% nitrogen, and I think it's a small amount of oxygen, and the divers actually will chamber in more oxygen as they go deeper because it's harder to absorb into their bloodstream. Nitrogen is actually good for us. If it was too much oxygen, we'd be super high. We'd stop breathing and asphyxiate, I guess.
Or, yeah, and adjust your CO2 levels there, Carnell.
That's a very unsettling.
Totally sympathetic breathing the whole time, hyperventilating.
I can't breathe.
He's hyperventilating.
I can't breathe.
Listen to me. Thin your mixture. Add CO2.
Can't find it.
I come. Wait. Oh, Christ.
I feel so stupid. How do you say stupid?
Durak.
And then there's the ISS itself, which they've now announced is going to be going out of commission in 2030.
Yep.
Also happened this week.
Would you be surprised if they don't extend that mission?
I was telling Mr. Scherer about it
when
I was reading it, and he was surprised that they didn't agree to extend it longer. But he said that it made sense in line with what they had done with Skylab.
Yeah.
Because they couldn't afford to handle both projects and move on. And so he predicted it exactly right. Next day, what do you read? That NASA is delegating this, commissioning private companies to take over and do the majority of the investing, the incentive being that it would be under their control. So NASA will relinquish the control over the ISS to private companies to incentivize more investment in it, which Mr. Scherer thinks is a mistake, and I kind of agree with him. Maybe, I don't know what you think, but in terms of just an international tactical signal to the future of space.
I think the whole point of the ISS is to get the collaboration between the nations, and especially the nation's governments, not the nation's commercial interests, because we've seen at this point how these mega corporations have been absolutely littering low Earth orbit, and you know the same's going to happen for the moon. And
with
the regulations is not there with commercial entities, and where, you know, we're paying tax dollars to fund.
It entirely has to be public interest, and there is regulation and open door check and balance. And that means handing over the baton to building the next space station to private companies and crashing the current ISS into the Pacific in 2030 like they did with Skylab. The reason being, for one thing, it was launched in 98, 99. What we both remember, it was a big deal in middle school. But it's actually constructed through the 90s based on the technology of the late 80s.
Yeah. Not to mention, we've got like micrometeorite, hull damage. You know, they've got several leaks that they're constantly having to reassess and seal. It is a collection tank for germs and bacteria, you know, this oxygen scrubbers and filters, and everything can be replaced and cleaned, but it's really starting to smell like your grandmother's van or something. It's got a little bit of age on it, and the sad thing is there's no big plans for new infrastructure. I think it's good that they're passing the baton. I think it's going to take a very talented agency to pull this off correctly. Because the modular way in which the ISS was constructed and the collaborative way that it brought, you know, the nations together was a very unique and innovative time for space technology. And I don't know if we necessarily have the guidance and the leadership to start something like that without it being heavily commercialized and leaning towards more tourism than science.
That's going to be the hard balance in order to get it funded and to get dedicated science and progress in tech to stay the main goal. But I guess for us, the cap on it all is going from Odysseus, the spacecraft, which, yes, was named for Homer, but was mostly named for this movie, 2001. Then come to find out this week that Blue Origin is going to be the one taking the contract for the next space station, and their plan is to maybe mitigate some of the effects of entropy and lack of exercise, zero G,
They're just going to open a Planet Fitness in low Earth orbit, basically.
So they decided instead they should maybe we'll try to simulate gravity. So what are they going to do? They're going to build a wheel.
Just like our beautiful wheel from 2001. this is just life imitating art at this point.
It's actually happening.
Now, if they can take a second payload of Arthur's ashes up to this station and maybe successfully place it.
Maybe can Jeff Koons place it in, seal it in something? But it's crazy, though. 30 years? Can you imagine? We wouldn't have ever thought. I mean, 30 years when we were in middle school anyway is an eternity. But to think of something firing off and say, okay, kids, in 30 years, people are still going to be using this in science.
No, it's crazy. I figure, honestly, I really thought we would have built something much grander at this point.
This is the chance to. Of course, it's going to be grander with the opportunities that are afforded by the new tech. Not only the cheaper, lighter solar panels and blacker blacks for solar absorption, but the biggest one of all, the inflatables.
Yes.
So they're going to have inflatable, so make it more modular, inflate compartments.
Easily deployable too. And apparently the walls of these are super tough. They're basically made out of Kevlar, aren't they? It's like a composite. Well, I think Kevlar is already a composite material, but it's like a composite material. Composite squared. And they take advantage of the flexibility, but the cool thing is it also has massive durability. The problem is with the metal hull of the ISS, once that gets penetrated by a micrometeorite, there's no real repairing it. You can replace that whole panel, but it's hard to do like a patchwork kind of deal with it. And I think this is a great step into making larger HABs, larger laboratories. This is going to be a very good option for, I think, lunar deployment too, before we start kind of excavating and potentially making more permanent settlements. We can use a very rapid deployment inflatable and use it as a staging area to move in more components and start the process of tunneling out, you know, a place to pour foundation.
And then when you're really talking about lunar construction, you know, this is almost like a way to start a system of insulated scaffolding.
Yeah.
To start building permanent structures, you got to have temporary structures, just like in big cities. You got the tarp over all the stuff that the you do not pass.
Yeah, absolutely. So that comes first. And I think for a long time, the ISS was supposed to be kind of that. And it served such a great purpose as like a modular lab, but also like a great way to shuttle back and forth, you know, supplies. And I think we're getting closer to more of like a permanent settlement as these lunar missions are becoming more frequent and more successful.
Jeremy, this is your first space trip.
Yeah.
Okay.
Pretty excited.
Do you have any questions, like for these guys? Not for me, for these guys. Of like things they don't teach you in astronaut school.
Well, yeah, there's definitely a few. I mean, I think there's a question we'll all have. We'll be the first humans to ride on this enormous rocket, and we'll be riding it up, and the whole way up we'll be like, is this normal? Is that normal? I have no idea.
What's that sound?
No one. These guys aren't going to be able to help me with that. I think the big one that astronauts, kind of like the secret handshake that astronauts pass down from one to the other because nobody on the ground can train it, is managing all the bodily functions, because you get that wrong in space and you don't have any more friends on board anymore.
That's true. Everybody's That's problem, true. Though. That's true.
At this time, I give you a go to resume count and launch Artemis 1.
And here we go.
10.
Hydrogen burn-off igniters initiate. Four-stage engine start. 3, 2, 1, boosters in ignition, and liftoff of Artemis 1.
Christine, I can't imagine the beauty of the Earth. Like, this is the shot from the cupola in the International Space Station right up there. And I really like to watch the live HD cameras that are on the ISS kind of soothe me during the day. I'll just keep it up on my computer screen. But explain to me what the overview effect is.
You know, it is absolutely gorgeous. Overview effect is when you're looking through that cupola, it's like the bay window looking down on the Earth. And you see just that, the Earth as it exists with the whole universe in the background. You see the thin blue line of the atmosphere. And then when you're on the dark side of the Earth, you actually see this very thin green line that shows you where the atmosphere is. And what you realize is every single person you know is sustained and inside of that green line, and everything else outside of it is completely inhospitable. You don't see borders, you don't see religious lines, you don't see political boundaries. All you see is Earth, and you see that we're way more alike than we are different.
50 years from now, we will look back and point to how our efforts to venture out into deep space began here. Our voyage out into the solar system started with this first flight.
And yet, this is but a prelude to what comes next.
So it's going to make predicting anything hard at this point, because
I like
two
that.
Years. Yeah.
I like that, the unpredictability, mm-hmm. because for so long it has been very slow progress, and now we're getting to kind of an explosive expansion point.
We're kind of hitting our next monolith.
Yeah, absolutely.
It's benchmark.
Man.
Clavia Space.
This is Brad.
I'm Wes. Signing off.
Thank you.
Bye. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.